Okay, that's it. You made an agreement and you broke it. You're not leaving this house on a Saturday again. I'm under house arrest? Indefinitely. What is it that you're so afraid of? What is it that you think I'm going to do? I'm hanging out with my friends. We discussed the war and other important things. I don't know why you want to know so much. You don't ask me a zillion fucking questions every time I go down to Hamlin's store. What are you so afraid of? You're just a bundle of fear. You just can't keep partying out here in the woods. Don't go spewing your fear all over me and making me as fearful as you and Mama. All you can deal with is cows. Cows and trees. Well, there's something besides cows and trees. There are people with real pain. Why don't you say it? Are you afraid I'm going to get laid? Is that what you're afraid of? I'm not that moronic to get knocked up. What have I ever done in my life that's irresponsible? You broke the agreement. That's the end of it. This is not a corporation. This is a business, Daddy. House arrest? Every day in this house is like being under house arrest. I don't like you very much when you act like this. Daddy, shut up. I don't like you either. I never did. Conversation number 44 about New York. The next Saturday. I'm not driving you to the train. You're not leaving the house. What are you going to do? Barricade me in? How are you going to stop me? You're going to tie me up in my high chair? Is that how you treat your daughter? I can't believe my own father would threaten me with physical force. I'm not threatening you with physical force. Then how are you going to keep me in the house? I'm not just one of Mom's dumb cows. I'm not going to live here forever and ever and ever, Mr. Cool, calm, and collected. What is it that you're so afraid of? What is it you're so afraid of people for? Haven't you ever heard that New York is one of the world's great cultural centers? People come from the whole world to experience New York. You always wanted me to experience everything else. Why can't I experience New York better than this dump here? What are you so angry about, that I might have a real idea of my own? Something that you didn't come up with first? Something that isn't one of your well-thought-out plans for the family and how things should go? All I'm doing is taking a fucking train into the city. Millions of men and women do it every day to go to work. Fall in with the wrong people. God forbid I should ever get another point of view. You married an Irish Catholic. What did your family think about you falling in with the wrong people? She married a Jew. What did her family think about her falling in with the wrong people? How much worse can I do? Maybe hang out with a guy with an afro? Is that what you're afraid of? I don't think so, Daddy. Why don't you worry about something that matters, like the war, instead of whether or not your overprivileged little girl takes a train into the big city by herself? Conversation number 53 about New York. You still won't tell me what kind of horrible fucking fate is going to befall me if I take a fucking train to the city. They have apartments and roofs in New York, too. They have locks and doors, too. A lock isn't something that's unique to old Rimrock, New Jersey. Ever think of that? Simon Lavov? It rhymes with the love. You think everything that is foreign to you is bad. Did you ever think that there are some things that are foreign to you that are good? And that as your daughter, I would have some instinct to go with the right people at the right time? You're always so sure I'm going to fuck up in some way. If you had any confidence in me, you think I might hang out with the right people. You don't give me any credit. Mary, you know what I'm talking about. You're involving yourself with political radicals. Radicals? Because they don't agree with you, they're radical? These are people who have very extreme political ideas. That's the only thing that gets anything done, is to have strong ideas, Daddy. But you're only 16 years old, and they're much older and more sophisticated than you. Good. So maybe I'll learn something. Extreme is blowing up a little country for some misunderstood notions about freedom. That is extreme. Blowing up boys' legs and balls. That is extreme, Daddy. Taking a bus or train into New York and spending a night in a locked, secure apartment. I don't see what's so extreme about that. I think people sleep somewhere every night if they can. Tell me what's so extreme about that. Do you think the war is bad? Extreme idea, Daddy? It's not the idea that's extreme. It's the fact that someone might care enough about something to try to make it different. You think that's extreme? That's your problem. It might mean more to someone to try to save other people's lives than to finish a degree at Columbia. That's extreme? No, the other is extreme. You're talking about Bill and Melissa? Yeah. She dropped out because there are things that are more important to her than degree. To stop the killing is more important to her than the letters B.A. on a piece of paper. You call that extreme? No, I think extreme is to continue on with life as usual when this kind of craziness is going on, when people are being exploited left, right, and center, and you can just go on and get into your suit and tie every day and go to work as if nothing is happening. That is extreme. That is extreme stupidity. That is what that is. Conversation number 59 about New York. Who are they? They went to Columbia. They dropped out. I told you all this. They live on Morningside Heights. That doesn't tell me enough, Mary. There are drugs. There are violent people. It's a dangerous city. Mary, you can wind up in a lot of trouble. You can wind up getting raped. But because I didn't listen to my daddy? That's not impossible. Girls wind up getting raped whether they listen to their daddies or not. Sometimes the daddies do the raping. Rapists have children, too. That's what makes them daddies. Tell Bill and Melissa to come here and spend the weekend with us. Oh, they'd really like to stay out here. Look, how would you like to go away to school in September? To prep school for your last 2 years. Maybe you've had enough of living at home, living with us here. Always planning, always trying to figure out the most reasonable course. Well, what else should I do? Not plan. I'm a man. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I run a business. I run a business. Therefore, I am. There are all kinds of schools. There are schools with all kinds of interesting people, with all kinds of freedom. You talk to your faculty advisor. I'll make inquiries, too. And if you're sick and tired of living with us, you can go away to school. I understand there isn't much for you to do out here anymore. Let's all think seriously about your going away to school. Conversation number 67 about New York. You can be as active in the anti-war movement as you like here in Morristown and in Old Rimrock. You can organize people here against the war. In your school... Daddy, I want to do it my... Wait, listen to me, please. Listen to me. The people here in Old Rimrock are not anti-war. To the contrary. You want to be in opposition? Be in opposition here. You can't do anything about it here. What am I going to do, march around the general store? You can organize here. Rimrockians against the war? That's going to make a big difference. Morristown High against the war. That's right. Bring the war home. Isn't that the slogan? So do it. Bring the war home to your town. You like to be unpopular? You'll be plenty unpopular, I can assure you. I'm not looking to be unpopular. Well, you will be. Because it's an unpopular position here. If you oppose the war here with all your strength, believe me, you'll make an impact. Why don't you educate people here about the war? This is part of America, too, you know. A minute part. These people are Americans, Mary. You can be actively against the war right here in the village. You don't have to go to New York. Yeah, I can be against the war in our living room. You can be against the war at the community club. All 20 people. Morristown is the county seat. Go into Morristown on Saturdays. There are people there who are against the war. Judge Fontaine is against the war. You know that? Mr. Avery is against the war. They signed the ad with me. The old judge went to Washington with me. People around here weren't very happy to see my name there, you know. But that's my position. You can organize a march in Morristown. You can work on the march. And the Morristown High School paper is going to cover it. That will get the troops out of Vietnam. I understand you're quite vocal about the war at Morristown High already. Why do we even bother if you don't think it matters? You do think it matters. Everyone's point of view in America matters in terms of this war. Start in your hometown, Mary. That's the way to end the war. Revolutions don't begin in the countryside. We're not talking about revolution. You're not talking about revolution. And that was the last conversation they ever had to have about New York. It worked. Interminable. But he was patient and reasonable and firm, and it worked. As far as he knew, she didn't go to New York again. She took his advice and stayed home. And after turning their living room into a battlefield, after turning Morristown High into a battlefield, she went out one day and blew up the post office, destroying right along with it Dr. Fred Conlin and the village's general store, a small wooden building with a community bulletin board out front and a single old Sunoco pump and the metal pole on which Russ Hamlin, who with his wife owned the store and ran the post office, had raised the American flag every morning since Warren Gamaliel Harding was president of the United States.
Fall.
tiny bone-white girl who looked half Mary's age, but claimed to be some 6 years older, a Miss Rita Cohen, came to the suite 4 months after Mary's disappearance. She was dressed like Dr. King's successor, Ralph Abernathy, in Freedom Rider overalls and ugly big shoes, and a bush of wiry hair emphatically framed her bland baby face. He should have recognized immediately who she was. For the 4 months he had been waiting for just such a person. But she was so tiny, so young, so ineffectual-looking, that he could barely believe she was at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business and Finance, doing a thesis on the leather industry in Newark, New Jersey, let alone the provocateur who was Mary's mentor in World Revolution. On the day she showed up at the factory, the Swede hadn't known that Rita Cohen had undertaken some fancy footwork, in and out through the basement door beneath the loading dock, so as to elude the surveillance team the FBI had assigned to observe from Central Avenue the arrival and departure of everyone visiting his office. 3-4 times a year, someone either called or wrote to ask permission to see the plant. In the old days, Lulavov, busy as he might be, always made time for the Newark school classes, or Boy Scout troops, or visiting notables chaperoned by a functionary from City Hall or the Chamber of Commerce. Though the Swede didn't get nearly the pleasure his father did from being an authority on the glove trade, though he wouldn't claim his father's authority on anything pertaining to the leather industry, pertaining to anything else either, occasionally he did assist a student by answering questions over the phone or, if the student struck him as especially serious, by offering a brief tour. Of course, had he known beforehand that this student was no student but his fugitive daughter's emissary, he would never have arranged their meeting to take place at the factory. Why Rita hadn't explained to the Swede whose emissary she was, said nothing about Mary until the tour had been concluded, was undoubtedly so she could size up the Swede first. Well, maybe she said nothing for so long, the better to enjoy toying with him. Maybe she just enjoyed the power. Maybe she was just another politician, and the enjoyment of power lay behind much of what she did. Because the Swede's desk was separated from the making department by glass partitions, he and the women at the machines could command a clear view of one another. He'd instituted this arrangement so as to wrest relief from the mechanical racket while maintaining access between himself and the floor. His father had refused to be confined to any office, glass enclosed or otherwise. Just planted his desk in the middle of the making room's 200 sewing machines, royalty right at the heart of the overcrowded hive, the swarm around him whining its buzzsaw bee buzz, while he talked to his customers and his contractors on the phone and simultaneously plowed through his paperwork. Only from out on the floor, he claimed, could he distinguish within the contrapuntal din the sound of a singer on the fritz, and with his screwdriver be over the machine before the girl had even alerted her forelady to the trouble. Vicky, Newark Maid's elderly black forelady, so testified with her brand of wry admiration at his retirement banquet. While everything was running without a hitch, Lou was impatient, fidgety. In a word, said Vicky, the insufferable boss. But when a cutter came around to complain about the foreman, when the foreman came around to complain about a cutter, when skins arrived months later in damaged condition or of poor quality, when he discovered a lining contractor cheating him on the yield or a shipping clerk robbing him blind, when he determined that the glove slitter with the red corvette and the sunglasses was, on the side, a bookie running a numbers game among the employees, then he was in his element, and in his inimitable way set out to make things right, so that when they were right, said the next-to-last speaker, the proud son, introducing his father in the longest, most laudatory of the evening's jocular encomiums, he could begin driving himself and the rest of us nuts with worrying again. But then, always expecting the worst, he was never disappointed for long, never caught off guard, either. All of which goes to show that, like everything else at Newark Maid, worrying works. Ladies and gentlemen, the man who's been my lifelong teacher, and not just in the art of worrying, the man who has made of my life a lifelong education, a difficult education sometimes, but always a profitable one, who explained to me when I was a boy of 5 the secret of making a product perfect. You work at it, he told me, Ladies and gentlemen, a man who has worked at it and succeeded at it since the day he went off to begin tanning hides at the age of 14, the Glover's Glover, who knows more about the glove business than anybody else alive, Mr. Newark Maid, my father, Lou Lvov. Look, began Mr. Newark Maid, don't let anybody kid you tonight. I enjoy working. I enjoy the glove business. I enjoy the challenge. I don't like the idea of retiring. I think it's the first step to the grave. But none of that bothers me for one big reason. Because I'm the luckiest man in the world. And lucky because of one word. The biggest little word there is. Family. If I was being pushed out by a competitor, I wouldn't be standing here smiling. You know me. I would be standing here shouting. But who I am being pushed out by is my own beloved son. I have been blessed with the most wonderful family a man could want. A wonderful wife, two wonderful boys, wonderful grandchildren. The Swede had Vicky bring a sheepskin into the office, and he gave it to the Wharton girl to feel. This has been pickled, but it hasn't been tanned, he told her. It's a hair sheepskin. Doesn't have wool like domestic sheep, but hair. What happens to the hair? She asked him. Does it get used? Good question. The hair is used to make carpet. Up in Amsterdam, New York, Bigelow, Mohawk, but the primary value is the skins. The hair is a byproduct. And how you get the hair off the skin and all the rest of it is another story entirely. Before synthetics came along, the hair mostly went into cheap carpets. There's a company that brokered all the hair from the tanneries to the carpet makers, but you don't want to get into that, he said, observing how, before they'd really even begun, she filled with notes the top sheet of a fresh yellow legal pad. Though if you do, he added, touched by and attracted by her thoroughness, because I suppose it does all sort of tie together. I could send you to talk to those people. I think the family's still around. It's a niche that not many people know about. It's interesting. It's all interesting. You've settled on an interesting subject, young lady. I think I have, she said, warmly smiling over at him. Anyway, this skin. He'd taken it back from her and was stroking it with the side of a thumb as you might stroke the cat to get the purr going. It's called a cabretta. In the industry's terminology, small sheep, little sheep, they only live 20 or 30 degrees north and south of the equator. They're sort of on a semi-wild grazing basis. Families in an African village will each own 4 or 5 sheep, and they'll all be flocked together and put out in the bush. What you were holding in your hand isn't raw anymore. We buy them in what's called the pickle stage. The hair's been removed, and the pre-processing has been done to preserve them, to get them here. We used to bring them in raw. Huge bales tied with rope and so on. Skins just dried in the air. I actually have a ship's manifest. It's somewhere here. I can find it for you if you want to see it. A copy of a ship's manifest from 1790 in which skins were landed in Boston, similar to what we were bringing in up to last year, and from the same ports in Africa. It could have been his father talking to her. For all he knew, every word of every sentence uttered by him he had heard from his father's mouth before he'd finished grade school, and then 2,000 or 3,000 times during the decades they'd run the business together. Trade talk was a tradition in glove families going back hundreds of years. In the best of them, the father passed the secrets on to the son along with all the history and all the lore. It was true in the tanneries, where the tanning process is like cooking, and the recipes are handed down from father to the son, and it was true in the glove shops, and it was true on the cutting room floor. The old Italian cutters would train their sons and no one else, and those sons accepted the tutorial from their fathers as he had accepted the tutorial from his. Beginning when he was a kid of 5 and extending into his maturity, the father, as the authority, was unopposed. Accepting his authority was one and the same with extracting from him the wisdom that had made Newark Maid manufacturer of the country's best ladies' glove. The Swede quickly came to love in the same wholehearted way the very things his father did and, at the factory, to think more or less as he did, and to sound as he did, if not on every last subject, then whenever a conversation came around to leather or Newark or gloves. Not since Mary had disappeared had he felt anything like this loquacious. Right up to that morning, all he'd been wanting was to weep or to hide. But because there was Dawn to nurse, and a business to tend to, and his parents to prop up, because everybody else was paralyzed by disbelief and shattered to the core, neither inclination had as yet eroded the protective front he provided the family and presented to the world. But now words were sweeping him on, buoying him up. His father's words, released by the sight of this tiny girl studiously taking them down. She was nearly as small, he thought, as the kids from Mary's third grade class, who'd been bused 38 miles from their rural schoolhouse one day back in the late 50s so that Mary's daddy could show them how he made gloves. Show them especially Mary's magical spot, the laying-off table, where, at the end of the making process, the men shaped and pressed each and every glove by pulling it carefully down over steam-heated brass hands veneered in chrome. The hands were dangerously hot, and they were shiny, and they stuck straight up from the table in a row, thin-looking as hands that had been flattened in a mangle and then amputated. Beautifully amputated hands afloat in space like the souls of the dead. As a little girl, Mary was captivated by their enigma. Called them the pancake hands. Mary, as a little girl, sang to her classmates, "You want to make $5 a dozen?" Which is what glove makers were always saying and what she'd been hearing since she was born. $5 a dozen. That was what you shot for, regardless. Mary whispering to the teacher, "People cheating on piece rates is always a problem. My daddy had to fire one man. He was stealing time." And the Swede telling her, "Honey, let Daddy conduct the tour, okay?" Mary, as a little girl reveling in the dazzling idea of stealing time. Mary, flitting from floor to floor, so proud and proprietary, flaunting her familiarity with all the employees, unaware as yet of the desecration of dignity inherent to the ruthless exploitation of the worker by the profit-hungry boss who unjustly owns the means of production. No wonder he felt so untamed, craving to spill over with talk. Momentarily, it was then again. Nothing blown up, nothing ruined. As a family, they still flew the flight of the immigrant rocket, the upward, unbroken immigrant trajectory from slave-driven great-grandfather to self-driven grandfather to self-confident, accomplished, independent father to the highest high flyer of them all. The fourth-generation child for whom America was to be heaven itself. No wonder he couldn't shut up. It was impossible to shut up. The Swede was giving in to the ordinary human wish to live once again in the past. To spend a self-deluding, harmless few moments back in the wholesome striving of the past. When the family endured by a truth in no way grounded in abetting destruction, but rather in eluding and outlasting destruction, overcoming its mysterious inroads by creating the utopia of a rational existence. He heard her asking, "How many come in a shipment?" "How many skins?" "A couple of thousand dozen skins." "A bale is how many?" He liked finding that she was interested in every last detail. Yes, talking to this attentive student up from Wharton, he was suddenly able to like something as he hadn't been able to like anything, to bear anything, even to understand anything he'd come up against for 4 lifeless months. He'd felt himself instead to be perishing of everything. "Oh, 120 skins, he replied. She continued taking notes as she asked, "They come right to your shipping department?" "They come to the tannery. The tannery is a contractor. We buy the material, and then we give it to them, and we give them the process to use, and then they convert it into leather for us. My grandfather and my father worked in the tannery right here in Newark. So did I for 6 months when I started in the business. Ever been inside a tannery?" "Not yet." "Well, you've got to go to a tannery if you're going to write about leather. I'll set that up for you if you'd like that. They're primitive places. The technology has improved things, but what you'll see isn't that different from what you would have seen hundreds of years ago. Awful work. Said to be the oldest industry of which relics have been found anywhere. 6,000-year-old relics of tanning found somewhere, Turkey, I believe. First clothing was just skins that were tanned by smoking them. I told you it was an interesting subject once you got into it. My father is the leather scholar. He's who you should be talking to, but he's living in Florida now. Start my father off about gloves, he'll talk for 2 days running. That's typical, by the way. Glovemen love the trade and everything about it. Tell me, have you ever seen anything manufactured, Miss Cohen?
I can't say I have.
Never seen anything made?
Saw my mother make a cake when I was a kid.
He laughed. She made him laugh, a feisty innocent, eager to learn. His daughter was easily a foot taller than Rita Cohen. Fair, where she was dark, but otherwise Rita Cohen, homely little thing though she was, had begun to remind him of Mary before her repugnance set in, and she began to become their enemy. The good-natured intelligence that would just waft out of her and into the house when she came home from school, overbrimming with what she learned in class. How she remembered everything. Everything neatly taken down in her notebook and memorized overnight. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We are going to bring you right through the whole process. Come on. We're going to make you a pair of gloves, and you're going to watch them being made from start to finish. What size do you wear?
I don't know. Small.
He'd gotten up from the desk and come around and taken hold of a hand. Very small. I'm guessing you're four. He'd already got from the top drawer of his desk a measuring tape with a D-ring at one end, and now he put it around her hand, threaded the other end through the D-ring, and pulled the tape around her palm.
We'll see what kind of guesser I am. Close your hand.
She made a fist, causing the hand to slightly expand, and he read the size in French inches. 4 it is. In a lady size, that's as small as they come. Anything smaller is a child's. Come on, I'll show you how it's done. He felt as though he'd step right back into the mouth of the past as they started, side by side, up the wooden steps of the old stairwell. He heard himself telling her, or simultaneously hearing his father telling her, "You always sort your skins at the northern side of the factory where there's no direct sunlight. That way you can really study the skins for quality. Where the sunlight comes in, you can't see. The cutting room and the sorting always on the northern side, sorting at the top. The second floor, the cutting, and the first floor, where you came, the making. Bottom floor, finishing and shipping, we're going to work our way from the top down." That they did. And he was happy. He couldn't help himself. It wasn't right. It wasn't real. Something must be done to stop this, but she was busy taking notes, and he couldn't stop. A girl who knew the value of hard work and paying attention and interest in the right things, interest in the preparation of leather and the manufacture of gloves, and to stop himself was impossible. When someone is suffering as the Swede was suffering, asking him to be undiluted by a momentary uplifting, however dubious its rationale, is asking an awful lot. In the cutting room, there were 25-minute work, about 6 to a table, and the Swede led her over to the oldest of them, whom he introduced as the master. A small, bald fellow with a hearing aid who continued working at a rectangular piece of leather. "That's the piece the glove is made from," said the Swede, "called a trank." Working at it with a ruler and shears all the time that the Swede was telling her just who this master was. With a light heart, still floating free, doing nothing to stop it, letting his father's patter flow. The cutting room was where the Swede had got inspired to follow his father into gloves, the place where he believed he'd grown from a boy into a man. The cutting room, up high and full of light, had been his favorite spot in the factory since he was just a kid, and the old European cutters came to work identically dressed in three-piece suits, starch white shirts, ties, suspenders, and cufflinks. Each cutter would carefully remove the suit coat and hang it in the closet, but no one in the Swede's memory had ever removed the tie, and only a very few descended to the informality of removing the vest, let alone turning up shirt sleeves before donning a fresh white apron and getting down to the first skin, unrolling it from the dampened muslin cloth and beginning the work of stretching. The wall of big windows to the north illuminated the hardwood cutting tables with the cool, even light you needed for grading and matching and cutting skins. The polished smoothness of the table's rounded edge, worked smooth over the years from all the animal skins stretched across it and pulled to length, was so provocative to the boy that he always had to restrain himself from rushing to press the concavity of his cheek against the convexity of the wood, restrained himself until he was alone. There was a blurry line of footprints worn into the wood floor, where the men stood all day at the cutting tables, and when no one else was up there, he liked to go and stand with his shoes where the floor was worn away. Watching the cutters work, he knew that they were the elite, and that they knew it, and the boss knew it. Though they considered themselves to be men more aristocratic than anyone around, including the boss,
Akutta's working hand was proudly calloused from cutting with his big, heavy shears. Beneath those white shirts were arms and chests and shoulders full of a working man's strength. Powerful they had to be to pull and pull on leather all their lives, to squeeze out of every skin every inch of leather there was. A lot of licking went on. A lot of saliva went into every glove, but, as his father joked, the customer never knows it. The cutter would spit into the dry, inking material in which he rubbed the brush for the stencil that numbered the pieces he cut from each trank. Having cut a pair of gloves, he would touch his finger to his tongue so as to wet the numbered pieces, to stick them together before they were rubber-banded for the sewing forelady and the sewers. What the boy never got over were those first German cutters employed by Newark Maine, who used to keep a schooner of beer beside them and sip from it, they said, to keep the whistle wet and their saliva flowing. Quickly enough, Lou Lavov had done away with the beer. But the saliva? Nah. Nobody could want to do away with the saliva. That was part and parcel of all they loved, the son and heir no less than the founding father. Harry can cut a glove as good as any of them. Harry, the master, stood directly beside the suite, indifferent to his boss's words and doing his work. He's only been 41 years with Newark Maid, but he works at it. The cutter has to visualize how the skin is going to realize itself into the maximum number of gloves. Then he has to cut it. Takes great skill to cut a glove right. Table cutting is an art. No two skins are alike. The skins all come in different, according to each animal's diet and age, everyone different as far as stretchability goes, and the skill involved in making every glove come out like every other is amazing. Same thing with the sewing. Kind of work people don't want to do anymore. You can't just take a sewer who knows how to run a traditional sewing machine or knows how to sew dresses and start a here on gloves. She has to go through a 3 or 4 month training process, has to have finger dexterity, has to have patience, and it's 6 months before she's proficient and reaches even 80% efficiency. Glove sewing is a tremendously complicated procedure. If you want to make a better glove, you have to spend money and train workers. It takes a lot of hard work and attention. All the twists and turns where the finger crotches are sewn, it's very hard. In the days when my father first opened a glove shop, the people were in it for life. Harry's the last of them. This cutting room is one of the last in the hemisphere. Our production is still always full. We still have people here who know what they're doing. Nobody cuts gloves this way anymore, not in this country, where hardly anybody's left to cut them, and not anywhere else either, except maybe in a little family-run shop in Naples or Grenoble. These were people, the people who worked here, who were in it for life. They were born into the glove industry, and they died in the glove industry. Today, we're constantly retraining people. Today, our economy is such that people take a job here, and if something comes along for another 50 cents an hour, they're gone. She wrote all this down. When I first came into the business and my father sent me up here to learn how to cut, all I did was stand right here at the cutting table and watch this guy. I learned this business in the old-fashioned way from the ground up. My father started me literally sweeping the floors, went through every single department, getting a feel for each operation and why it was being done. From Harry, I learned how to cut a glove. I wouldn't say I was a proficient glove cutter. If I cut 2-3 pairs a day, it was a lot. But I learned the rudimentary principles. Right, Harry? A demanding teacher, this fellow. When he shows you how to do something, he goes all the way. Learning from Harry almost made me yearn for my old man. First day I came up here, Harry set me straight. He told me that down where he lived, boys could come to his door and say, "Could you teach me to be a glove cutter?" And he would tell them, "You've got to pay me $15,000 first, because that's how much time and leather you're going to destroy till you get to the point where you can make the minimum wage." I watched him for a full 2 months before he let me anywhere near a hide. An average table cutter will cut 3-3.5 dozen a day. A good fast table cutter will cut 5 dozen a day. Harry was cutting 5.5 dozen a day. "You think I'm good?" he told me. "You should have seen my dad." Then he told me about his father and the tall man from Barnum and Bailey. "Remember Harry?" Harry nodded. When the Barnum and Bailey Circus came to Newark, this is 1917, 1918, Harry nodded again without stopping his work. "Well, they came to town, and they had a tall man approaching 9 feet or so, and Harry's father saw him one day in the street, walking along the street at Broughton Market, and he got so excited he ran over to the tall man, and he took a shoelace off his own shoe, measured the guy's hand right out there on the street, and he went home and made up a perfect size 17 pair of gloves. Harry's father cut it, his mom sewed it, and they went over to the circus, gave the gloves to the tall man, and the whole family got free seats. And a big story about Harry's dad ran in the Newark News the next day. Harry corrected him. The Star Eagle. Right, before it merged with the Ledger. Wonderful, the girl said, laughing. Your father must have been very skilled. Couldn't speak a word of English, Harry told her. He couldn't? Well, that just goes to show you don't have to know English, she said, to cut a perfect pair of gloves for a man 9 feet tall. Harry didn't laugh, but the Swede did. Laughed and put his arm around her. This is Rita. We're going to make her a dress glove size 4, black or brown, honey. Brown? From a wrapped-up bundle of hides dampening beside Harry, he picked out one in a pale shade of brown. This is a tough color to get, the Swede told her. British tan. You can see there's all sorts of variation in the color. See how light it is there, how dark it is down there? Okay, this is sheepskin. What you saw in my office was pickled. This has been tanned. This is leather. But you can still see the animal. If you were to look at the animal, he said, here it is, the head, the butt, the front legs, the hind legs, and here's the back, where the leather is harder and thicker as it is over our own backbones. Honey. He began calling her honey up in the cutting room, and he couldn't stop. And this even before he understood that by standing beside her, he was as close to Mary as he had been since the general store blew up, and his honey disappeared. This is a French ruler. It's about an inch longer than an American ruler. This is called a spud knife, dull, beveled to an edge, but not sharp. Now he's pulling the trank down like that to the length again. Harry likes to bet you that he'll pull it right down to the pattern without even touching the pattern, but I don't bet him because I don't like losing. This is called a fourchette. See? All meticulously done. He's going to cut yours and give it to me so we can take it down to the making department. This is called the slitter, honey. Only mechanical process in the whole thing. A press and a die, and the slitter will take about 4 tranks at a time. Wow! This is an elaborate process, said Rita. That it is. It's hard, really, to make money in the glove business because it's so labor-intensive. A time-consuming process. Many operations to be coordinated. Most of the glove businesses have been family businesses, from father to son. Very traditional business. A product is a product to most manufacturers. The guy who makes them doesn't know anything about them. The glove business isn't like that. This business has a long, long history. Do other people feel the romance of the glove business the way you do, Mr. Leveau? You really are mad for this place and all the processes. I guess that's what makes you a happy man. Am I? He asked, and felt as though he were going to be dissected, cut into by a knife, opened up, and all his misery revealed. I guess I am. Are you the last of the Mohegans? No. Most of them, I believe, in this business have that same feeling for the tradition, that same love. Because it does require a love and a legacy to motivate somebody to stay in a business like this. You have to have strong ties to it to be able to stick it out. Come on, he said, having managed momentarily to quash everything that was shadowing him and menacing him. Succeeded still to be able to speak with great precision, despite her telling him he was a happy man. Let's go back to the making room. This is the silking. That's a story in itself, but this is what she's going to do first. This is called a piqué machine. It sews the finest stitch, called piqué, requires far more skill than the other stitches. This is called a polishing machine, and that's called a stretcher, and you are called honey, and I am called daddy, and this is called living, and the other is called dying, and this is called madness, and this is called mourning, and this is called hell, pure hell, and you have to have strong ties to be able to stick it out. This is called trying to go on as though nothing has happened, and this is called paying the full price, but in God's name, for what? This is called wanting to be dead, and wanting to find her, and to kill her, and to save her from whatever she is going through, wherever on earth she may be at this moment, this unbridled outpouring is called blotting out everything, and it does not work. I am half insane. The shattering force of that bomb is too great. Then they were back in his office again, waiting for Rita's gloves to come from the finishing department, and he was repeating to her a favorite observation of his father's, one that his father had read somewhere and always used to impress visitors, and he heard himself repeating it word for word as his own. If only he could get her to stay and not go. If he could keep on talking about gloves to her, about gloves, about skins, about his horrible riddle, implore her, beg her, don't leave me alone with this horrible riddle. monkeys, gorillas, they have brains, and we have a brain, but they don't have this thing, the thumb. They can't move it opposite the way we do. The inner digit on the hand of a man, that might be the distinguishing physical feature between ourselves and the rest of the animals. And the glove protects that inner digit. The lady's glove, the welder's glove, the rubber glove, the baseball glove, etc. This is the root of humanity, the supposable thumb. It enables us to make tools and build cities and everything else, more than the brain. Maybe some other animals have bigger brains in proportion to their bodies than we have. I don't know. But the hand itself is an intricate thing. It moves. There is no other part of a human body that is clothed, that is such a complex moving structure. And that was when Vicky popped in the door with the size 4 finished gloves. "Here's your pair of gloves," Vicky said, and gave them to the boss, who looked them over and then leaned across the desk to show them to the girl. "See the seams? The width of the sewing at the edge of the leather. That's where the quality workmanship is. This margin is probably about a 1/32 of an inch between stitching and the edge. And that requires a high skill level, far higher than normal. If a glove isn't well sewn, this edge might come to 1/8 of an inch. It also will not be straight. Look at how straight these seams are. This is why a Newark-made glove is a good glove, Rita, because of the straight seams, because of the fine leather. It's well tanned. It's soft. It's pliable. Smells like the inside of a new car. I love good leather. I love fine gloves. And I was brought up on the idea of making the best glove possible. It's in my blood. And nothing gives me greater pleasure. He clutched at his own effusiveness, the way a sick person clutches at any sign of health, no matter how minute. "Then giving you these lovely gloves here," he said. With our compliments and smiling, he presented the gloves to the girl, who excitedly pulled them onto her little hands. "Slowly, slowly, always draw on a pair of gloves by the fingers," he told her. "Afterward, the thumb, then draw the wrist down in place. Always the first time, draw them on slowly." And she looked up and, smiling back at him with the pleasure that any child takes in receiving a gift, showed him with her hands in the air how beautiful the gloves looked, how beautifully they fit. "Close your hand. Make a fist," the sweet said. "Feel how the glove expands where your hand expands and nicely adjusts to your size. That's what the cutter does when he does his job right. No stretch left in the length. He pulled that all out at the table because you don't want the fingers to stretch, but an exactly measured amount of hidden stretch left in the width. That stretch in the width is a precise calculation." "Yes, yes, it's wonderful. Absolutely perfect," she told him, opening and closing her hands in turn. "God bless the precise calculators of this world," she said, laughing, "who leave stretch hidden in the width." And only after Vicky had shut the door to his glass-enclosed office and headed back into the racket of the making department did Rita add, very softly, "She wants her Audrey Hepburn scrapbook." The next morning, the Swede met Rita at the Newark Airport parking lot to give her the scrapbook. From his office, he had first driven to Branchbrook Park, miles in the opposite direction from the airport, where he got out of the car to take a solitary walk. He strolled along where the Japanese cherry trees were blooming. For a while, he sat on a bench, watching the old people with their dogs. Then, back in the car, he just began to drive, through Italian North Newark, and on up to Belleville, making right turns for half an hour, until he determined that he wasn't being followed. Rita had warned him not to make his way to their rendezvous otherwise. The second week, at the airport parking lot, he handed over the ballet slippers and the leotard Merritt had last worn at age 14. 3 days after that, it was his stuttering diary. "Surely," he said, having decided that now, with the diary in his hands, the time had come to repeat the words his wife had spoken to him before each of his meetings with Rita, meetings in which he had scrupulously done nothing other than what Rita asked and deliberately asked nothing of her in return. "Surely, you can now tell me something about Mary, if not where she is, how she is." "I surely cannot,"
Rita said sourly. I'd like to speak with her. Well, she won't like to speak with you. But if she wants these things, why else would she want these things? Because they're hers. So are we hers, miss. Not to hear her tell it, I can't believe that. She hates you. Does she? He asked lightly. She thinks you ought to be shot. Yes, that too. What do you pay the workers in your factory in Ponce, Puerto Rico? What do you pay the workers who stitch gloves for you in Hong Kong and Taiwan? What do you pay the women going blind in the Philippines, hand-stitching designs to satisfy the ladies shopping at Bonwitz? You're nothing but a shitty little capitalist who exploits the brown and yellow people of the world and lives in luxury behind the nigger-proof security gates of his mansion. Till now, the Swede had been civil and soft-spoken with Rita, no matter how menacing she was determined to be. Rita was all they had. She was indispensable. And though he didn't expect to change her any by keeping his emotions to himself, each time he steeled himself to show no desperation. Taunting him was the project she had set herself. Imposing her will on this conservatively dressed success story, 6 feet, 3 inches tall, and worth millions, clearly provided her with one of life's great moments. But then it was all great moments these days. They had Mary, 16-year-old stuttering Mary. They had a live human being and her family to play with. Rita was no longer an ordinary wavering mortal, let alone a novice in life, but a creature in clandestine harmony with the brutal way of the world, entitled in the name of historical justice to be just as sinister as the capitalist oppressor Swede Lvov. The unreality of being in the hands of this child. This loathsome kid with a head full of fantasies about the working class. This tiny being who took up not even as much space in the car as the Lvov sheepdog, pretending that she was striding on the world stage. This utterly insignificant pebble. What was the whole sick enterprise other than angry, infantile egoism thinly disguised as identification with the oppressed? Her weighty responsibility to the workers of the world? Egoistic pathology bristled out of her like the hair that nuttily proclaimed, I go wherever I want, as far as I want, and all that matters is what I want. Yes, the nonsensical hair constituted half of their revolutionary ideology. About as sound a justification for her actions as the other half, the exaggerated jargon about changing the world. She was 22 years old, no more than 5 feet tall, and off on a reckless adventure with a very potent thing way beyond her comprehension called power. Not the least need of thought. Thought just paled away beside their ignorance. They were omniscient without even thinking. No wonder his tremendous effort to hide his agitation was thwarted momentarily by uncontrollable rage. And sharply he said to her, as though he were not joined to her maniacally uncompromising mission in the most unimaginable way, as though it could matter to him that she enjoyed thinking the worst of him. You have no idea what you're talking about. American firms make gloves in the Philippines and Hong Kong and Taiwan and India and Pakistan and all over the place, but not mine. I own two factories. Two. One of my factories you visited in Newark. You saw how unhappy my employees were. That's why they've worked for us for 40 years, because they're exploited so miserably. The factory in Puerto Rico employs 260 people, Miss Cohen. People we have trained from scratch, people we trust, people who, before we came to Ponce, had barely enough work to go around. We furnish employment where there was a shortage of employment. We have taught needle skills to Caribbean people who had few, if any, of these skills. You know nothing. You know nothing about anything. You didn't even know what a factory was till I showed you one. I know what a plantation is, Mr. Lvov. I know what it means to run a plantation. You take good care of your niggers. Of course you do. It's called paternal capitalism. You own them, you sleep with them, and when you're finished with them, you toss them out. Lynch them only when necessary. Use them for your sport, and use them for your profit. Please. Please. I haven't 2 minutes' interest in childish cliches. You don't know what a factory is. You don't know what manufacturing is. You don't know what capital is. You don't know what labor is. You haven't the faintest idea what it is to be employed or what it is to be unemployed. You have no idea what work is. You've never held a job in your life, and if you even cared to find one, you wouldn't last a single day, not as a worker, not as a manager, not as an owner. Enough nonsense. I want you to tell me where my daughter is. That is all I want to hear from you. She needs help. She needs serious help, not ridiculous cliches. I want you to tell me where I can find her. Mary never wants to see you again, or
That mother. You don't know anything about Mary's mother. Lady Dawn. Lady Dawn of the Manor. I know all there is to know about Lady Dawn. So ashamed of her class origins, she has to make her daughter into a debutante. Mary shoveled cow shit from the time she was 6. You don't know what you're talking about. Mary was in the 4-H club. Mary rode tractors. Mary, fake. All fake. The daughter of the beauty queen and the captain of the football team. What kind of nightmare is that for a girl with a soul? The little shirt waist dresses, the little shoes, the little this and the little that. Always playing with her hair. You think she wanted to fix Mary's hair because she loved her? And the way she looked? Or because she was disgusted with it? Disgusted she couldn't have a baby beauty queen that could grow up in her own image to become Miss Rimrock? Mary was to have dancing lessons. Mary was to have tennis lessons. I'm surprised she didn't get a nose job. You don't know what you're talking about. Why do you think Mary had the hots for Audrey Hepburn? Because she thought that was the best chance she had with that vain little mother of hers, Miss Vanity of 1949. Hard to believe you could fit so much vanity into that cutesy figure. Oh, but it does. It fits all right. Just doesn't leave much room for Mary, does it? You don't know what you're saying. No imagination for somebody who isn't beautiful and lovable and desirable, none. The frivolous, trivial beauty queen mentality and no imagination for her own daughter. I don't want to see anything messy. I don't want to see anything dark. But the world isn't like that, Dawnie dear. It is messy. It is dark. It's hideous. Mary's mother works a farm all day. She works with animals all day. She works with farm machinery all day. She works from 6 a.m. to fake, fake, fake. She works a farm like a fucking upper class. You don't know anything about any of this. Where's my daughter? Where is she? The conversation is pointless. Where's Mary? You don't remember the now-you-are-a-woman party to celebrate her first menstruation? We're not talking about any party. What party? We're talking about the humiliation of a daughter by her beauty queen mother. We're talking about a mother who completely colonized her daughter's self-image. We're talking about a mother who didn't have an inch of feeling for her daughter, who has about as much depth as those gloves you make. A whole family, and all you really fucking care about is skin. Ectoderm. Surface. But what's underneath? You don't have a clue. You think that was real affection she had for that stuttering girl? She tolerated that stuttering girl, but you can't tell the difference between affection and tolerance because you're too stupid yourself. Another one of your fucking fairy tales. A menstruation party? A party for Jesus? You mean, no, that wasn't that. The party? You mean when she took all her friends to White House for dinner? That was her 12th birthday. What is this? Now you are a woman, crap. It was a birthday party. Nothing to do with menstruating. Nothing. Who told you this? Mary didn't tell you this. I remember that party. She remembers that party. It was a simple birthday party. We took all those girls down to that restaurant in White House. They had a wonderful time. We had 10, 12-year-old girls. This is all crack. Somebody is dead. My daughter is being accused of murder. Rita was laughing. Mr. Law-abiding New Jersey fucking citizen, a little bit of fake affection looks just like love to him. But what you're describing never happened. What you're saying never happened. It would have mattered if it did, but it didn't. Don't you know what's made Mary Mary? 16 years of living in a household where she was hated by that mother. For what? Tell me. Hated her for what? Because she was everything Lady Dawn wasn't. Her mother hated her, sweet. It's a shame you're so late in finding out. Hated her for not being petite, for not being able to have her hair pulled back in that oh-so-spiffy country way. Mary was hated with that hatred that seeps into you like toxin. Lady Dawn couldn't have done a better job if she slipped poison into her a meal at a time. Lady Dawn would look at her with that look of hatred, and Mary was turned into a piece of shit. That was no look of hatred. Something may have gone wrong, but that wasn't it. That wasn't hatred. I know what she's talking about. What you're calling hatred was her mother's anxiety. I know the look. But it was about the stuttering. My God, it wasn't hatred. It was the opposite. It was concern. It was distress. It was helplessness. Still protecting that wife of yours, said Rita, laughing at him again. Incredible incomprehension. Simply incredible. You know why else she hated her? She hated her because she's your daughter. It's all fine and well for Miss New Jersey to marry a Jew, but to raise a Jew? That's a whole other bag of tricks. You have a Shiksa wife, Swede, but you didn't get a Shiksa daughter. Miss New Jersey is a bitch, Swede. Mary would have been better off sucking the cows if she wanted a little milk and nurturance. At least the cows have maternal feelings. He had allowed her to talk. He had allowed himself to listen only because he wanted to know. If something had gone wrong, of course, he wanted to know. What is the grudge? What is the grievance? That was the central mystery. How did Mary get to be who she is? But none of this explained anything. This couldn't be what it was all about. This couldn't be what lay behind the blowing up of the building, no. A desperate man was giving himself over to a treacherous girl, not because she could possibly begin to know what went wrong, but because there was no one else to give himself over to. He felt less like someone looking for an answer than like someone mimicking someone who was looking for an answer. This whole exchange had been a ridiculous mistake. To expect this kid to talk to him truthfully, she couldn't insult him enough. Everything about their lives transformed absolutely by her hatred. Here was the hater, this insurrectionist child. Where is she? Why do you want to know where she is? I want to see her, he said. Why? She's my daughter. Somebody is dead. My daughter is being accused of murder. You're really stuck on that, aren't you? Do you know how many Vietnamese have been killed in the few minutes we've had the luxury to talk about whether or not Donnie loves her daughter? It's all relative, Swede. Death is all relative. Where is she? Your daughter is safe. Your daughter is loved. Your daughter is fighting for what she believes in. Your daughter is finally having an experience of the world. Where is she, damn you? She's not a possession, you know. She's not property. She's not powerless anymore. You don't own Mary the way you own your old Rimrock house and your Deal house and your Florida condo and your Newark factory and your Puerto Rican factory and your Puerto Rican workers and all your Mercedes and all your Jeeps and all your beautiful handmade suits. You know what I've come to realize about you kindly rich liberals who own the world? Nothing is further from your understanding than the nature of reality. No one begins like this, the Swede thought. This can't be what she is. This bullying infant, this obnoxious, stubborn, angry, bullying infant cannot be my daughter's protector. She's a jailer. Mary, with all her intelligence, under the spell of this childlike cruelty and meanness. There's more human sense in one page of the stuttering diary than in all the sadistic idealism in this reckless child's head. Oh, to crush that hairy, tough little skull of hers right now between his two strong hands, to squeeze it and squeeze it until all the vicious ideas come streaming from her nose. How does a child get to be like this? Can anyone be utterly without thoughtfulness? The answer is yes. His only contact with his daughter was this child who didn't know anything and wouldn't say anything and more than likely do anything, resort to anything to excite herself. Her opinions were all stimuli. The goal was excitement. The paragon, Rita said, speaking to him out of the side of her mouth, as though that would make it all the easier to wreck his life. The cherished and triumphant paragon, who is in actuality the criminal, the great Swede Lvov, all-American capitalist criminal. She was some clever child crackpot, gorging herself on an escapade entirely her own, a reprehensible child lunatic who'd never laid eyes on Mary except in the paper. Some politicized crazy was what she was. The streets of New York were full of them, a criminally insane Jewish kid who picked up her facts about their lives from the newspapers and the TV and from the school friends of Mary's who were all out peddling the same quotation. Quaint old Rimrock is in for a big surprise. From the sound of it, Mary had gone around school the day before the bombing telling that to 400 kids. That was the evidence against her. All these kids on TV claiming they heard her say it. That hearsay and her disappearance were the whole of the evidence. The post office had been blown up, and the general store along with it, but nobody had seen her anywhere near it. Nobody had seen her do the thing. Nobody would have even thought of her as the bomber if she hadn't disappeared. She's been tricked. For days, Dawn went around the house crying, "She's been abducted. She's been tricked. She's somewhere, right now, being brainwashed." Why does everybody say she did it? Nobody had any contact with her. She's not connected with it in any way at all. How can they believe this of a child? Dynamite? What does Mary have to do with dynamite? No, it isn't true. Nobody knows a thing. You should have informed the FBI of Rita Cohen's visit the day she'd come to ask for the scrapbook. At the very least, should have demanded proof from her of Mary's existence.
And he should have taken into his confidence someone other than Dawn.